From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For 6 million years, the Colorado River ran to the sea. It made its way some 1,500 miles, drained 7 western states, emptied millions of acre-feet of water into a verdant delta. But then sometime in the late 1990s, the flow pretty much stopped. As a new documentary about the river points out, the demands from agriculture, from industry, from energy production, from 30 million people in growing cities transformed the Colorado into the most dammed, the most dibbed, and the most diverted river basin in the world. Today in the program, we're profiling the film and the story of the river and its relationship with the growing West. Experts say that growth, along with climate change, means there's a coming crisis unless something changes. We'll talk about it today after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A new documentary about the Colorado River explores how, over the course of a few decades, one of the wildest rivers on the planet was transformed into the most dammed, the most dibbed, and most diverted river basin in the world. There have always been disputes and demands on that water. Take the needs of 30 million people, which includes agriculture and industry and energy production and urban growth. Combine that with a changing climate and a population expected to add some 20 million to the West in the next 40 years or so, and some are seeing a crisis coming. Today in the program, we're profiling this film and the people in it. The film explores how you reshape old compacts, how you look at new frontiers of cooperation and conservation. It talks about how you change the idea of producing food and creating energy and growing cities. But the central concept is this idea of creating a new water ethic for the West. We're talking about it, and we invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Peter McBride is with us, an award-winning photographer and filmmaker. He's produced a book called The Colorado River, Flowing Through Conflict, as well as a documentary about the river that he's called Chasing Water. And he's joining us today from his home in Colorado. And Peter McBride, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I wanted to start with your own your initial impressions of the river, at least your initial journey and this concept. You grew up, as I understand it, on a cattle ranch in Colorado, and at some point you saw the creeks that were flowing through your land, and you wanted to trace it. You wanted to see how that becomes the Colorado, and then where the Colorado ends up, I guess. Is that the initial idea?
Yeah, it was somewhat of a childhood fascination. I looked at water growing up on a cattle ranch. We'd flood irrigate, and I always had a lot of time trying to anticipate where the water would go, and I thought about it a lot and started wondering what would happen if that water actually, where it would go and how long it would take to actually reach the sea. So essentially, decades later, I ended up following it. And sadly, in my experience, I realized that the water doesn't reach the sea. So the question of how long it would take today is actually never until we actually change our practices with the river and figure out a way to maybe restore this health, which I actually think is doable. It takes a little bit of will and initiative, but it's not out of the question.
Doable, and this is one of the things that James Redford's documentary gets into, this idea that it would, if you could get 2% of the water to stay in the river, that it could actually make its way to the Sea of Cortez.
I think potentially even less. The real question is how much water has been removed from the water table, which, of course, water tables and rivers are linked intrinsically. And we're not only are we pulling from the river, but we're pulling with wells throughout the Southwest. We're pulling from the water table. So that's the big question mark right now. But I think in between 1% to 2%, we could dedicate a base flow and then have a pulse flow to reenact kind of the historic floods that did happen. And so I think it is doable, and it's going to take some, I've heard, anywhere from $15 to $20 million, which in the scheme of the water world is not that much money at all. And I think it is, which Jamie's film addresses, is changing this whole kind of concept of how we look at water in the Southwest. And what is the best use for it. Should it stay in the river, or should we divert it all? And I think there's a great amount of value actually in water in the river, as well as for other industries and agriculture and municipalities. I think it's just a fine dance that we need to thread.
One of the things I wanted to get from you as we go along, Peter McBride, is because there's one thing that you get a sense about in the film and your work as well, is what it was like before it did dry up. You know, what it was like, and you've been there. You've seen the kind of desolation that's there at the end of the line now. Do you have any sense? Do we have any sense of what it was like before all of that?
That's what's so amazing and what's so remarkable to me is, so I documented the river source to sea all the way from the Rocky Mountains to the Sea of Cortez. And historically, we used to actually run steamships. If you wanted to go from Yuma, Arizona on the border to, say, San Francisco, you would ride a steamship down the Colorado River Delta to the Sea of Cortez, meet a cargo ship, and go around Baja. And I joined up with a fellow writer, and we actually ran out of water in what I affectionately call the Frappuccino Pit. It was this frothy, kind of murky mud pit right below the U.S.-Mexican border. And that was about 90 miles shy of the Sea of Cortez. And we walked what was once the largest desert estuary in North America. And there was people talked about the estuary having jaguars and cottonwoods and teeming with life and biodiversity. And now it's just a crack and chapped into the Sonoran Desert around it. And so we basically created a new desert there. And that's what I think is so remarkable. And most people just don't realize that I spend a lot of time talking about this issue. And the vast majority of the people, including myself when I started this project, have no idea what's become of the mighty, loved, and of course litigated Colorado River. It somewhat alarms people to learn that it actually runs dry and not a drop of it has reached the sea since the late 90s.
Mm. It seems like for people who write about the river and take pictures of the river and try to document the river, that it has its own kind of character to it. Is that overstating it? Or, I mean, how do you describe the Colorado?
I would agree with that point. I think it has a tremendous character. It's like this living entity that flows through an alien world almost. I mean, it looks like it shouldn't belong, but it does, and it sustains life. You said initially in the beginning of the show it's 30 million people. That's actually swelled now. 36 is the last study I've heard. So it's supporting this huge, vast population, and I think it has this amazing life, and most people know of it around the world and love it for the Grand Canyon and think of it as this beautiful, wild, majestic river. But the reality is we've turned it into, in my opinion, a piece of plumbing. And there are plenty of people in the Southwest that believe that water in a river is wasted water. And at the same time, they've done studies on the Colorado River recently that on all the recreation that happens around the river, and they have a figure of $26 billion that the river brings in, which if you put it on the Forbes 500 list, it would come in at 119, I believe, would be ahead of U.S. Airways and Progressive Insurance.
Mm.
And so actually a flowing river for recreation is a huge economic engine. And I think sometimes we forget that. Of course, it's an engine to divert water for ag. Ag takes the lion's share of the river, almost 80%. And I think there's a tremendous amount of room there for greater efficiency. At the same time, we do need ag. We want to eat food locally. And cities take a chunk. Industry and energy is really one of the next big ones behind ag. And these are all important, but I think we need to consider the inflow stream rights of a river like this. It does have a big economic engine behind it.
Yeah. Well, we're going to get into some of those details as we go along. Stay with us, if you would, Peter McBride. Joining us on the program is James Redford. He writes, produces, and directs for film and television. He's one of the producers of the film, which is called Watershed. We'll give you details about all of that as we go. Earlier this year, his documentary film, The D Word, Understanding Dyslexia, premiered at Sundance. And he's joining us today from the Sundance Institute in Utah. James Redford, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
I'm glad to be here.
I wanted to start with you on what it is that got you thinking first about this idea, if not for the film, at least the river itself. How were you thinking about this at first, Jamie?
Well, I think, this film was produced by the Redford Center, which is a family nonprofit my sisters and my father and I created in belief that storytelling is a key component to social change, positive social change, at least from our point of view. So, you know, that was something we put forth as something we wanted to do. The specific issue of water, you know, having spent all my summers and all my vacations in Utah growing up, I had sort of a schizophrenic childhood between Manhattan and Utah. And so, you know, but I'm very familiar with the landscape out here. And yes, we used to go to Lake Powell when I was a kid, and we would watch every year as the lake was filling up, watch the landscape change. And there was sort of an eerie fascination. It's almost like a morbid curiosity going down to that lake, because every year it was a different campground. Every year it was a different landscape. You were eerily aware that there were roads and ranger stations below you somewhere. So there was sort of this visceral awareness of what we've done to that canyon, the Glen Canyon. So it was in our minds. But I think most importantly, in terms of, you know, looking forward, my father has always been an extraordinary visionary. I mean, to think back on 1989, that he brought together Soviet and American climate scientists here at the Sundance Resort to have a conference on this thing called the greenhouse effect, and did everything he could to create media awareness around the issue of climate change way ahead of his time. There wasn't a whole lot of belief, enthusiasm, excitement, concern about that issue then. I would say water has been equally on his mind the whole way through, and we're now beginning to see that, you know, it's now becoming a reality. A lot of his concerns over the decades are now realities, and we feel that as Westerners, telling the story of water is just really critical, and telling it broadly and accessibly to the public at large, to start with a 101 level accounting of exactly what's at stake.
I wanted to ask you something that comes up in the film from time to time, and it's this perspective from the explorer John Wesley Powell, who warned, as you point out in the film, that if you combine dry land, arid land, and civilization, at some point there's going to be a crisis. Talk about that, because that's this theme that comes up in the film again a couple of times, actually.
Well, I see it a little differently than that, and I think that's maybe where the positive or more optimistic tone that's in the movie inhabits its space, which is that, you know, what in my mind what Powell said is really that if we're going to populate this arid environment, you know, beyond the 100th meridian, we're going to have to live differently. You know, the historic pattern was for Easterners to come west, look for extractive opportunities and go back, or recreate society as they knew it on the eastern seaboard. So you have all kinds of the recreation of the eastern landscape here in the west, which Powell said, you know, that's just not going to work. If we're going to move west, we have to start reflecting. The way we live has to be in line with what the reality of that landscape is. So he really saw the aridity as something we needed to pay attention to and let it inform the way we live, and we just have not done that.
What do you figure, how do you describe, Jamie, the stakes that are at play in this story, you know, in terms of water, the Colorado? Is the Colorado sort of a symbol for something bigger, do you think, in some ways?
Well, I do, because I think if it's not water quantity that's the problem that we're facing, it's water quality. And that's why I feel like everybody should see this film. Everyone should look at the Colorado. And I also feel like the Colorado River is it's not only worth saving and reconnecting to the Delta. I mean, you heard, if you ever have a chance to see Peter McBride's photographs, they're horrifying and beautiful, and they're stark, they're stunning, they're gripping. I mean, you see something there that is so out of balance and so honest and raw, and that is a landscape that can be reclaimed. we can actually save, we can bring that delta back to life. It's not out of our ability. And so, you know, focusing on things that can be done, I think is really important. And that's what we're driving towards with this movie, is creating an awareness first. But it's really only the beginning. You know, we're committed. We're going to do our part, as Peter is doing, as the Nature Conservancy, as the Packard Foundation, as Environmental Defense Fund, Pro Natura Noreste. The list goes on and on. Save the Colorado, our sponsor for the screenings. We all feel like this is a problem we can do something about.
You know, what's interesting about the film is that I've seen my share of sort of reports and pieces on the Colorado, and if you're not careful, you can really get into really complicated conversations about water law and policy and those kinds of things. But the take you have in the film is to explore it through stories of people. These are profiles of people. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, I think under, you know, there's so much content out there today. How do you make a difference? How do you get people's attention, particularly on an issue like water, which immediately people's eyes roll back in their head? I think, you know, how are you going to do that?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I think visual media is a great tool. And I think human stories is another one, because we can all relate to each other a lot more than we can statistics and numbers. So, and also we want to build some, you know, we're trying to build an awareness among a broad constituency in the West on this issue. I mean, it's, you know, some folks are surprised that we're not being more aggressive about agriculture. Now, personally, you know, I think there's, and particularly industry, having just driven from Aspen to Sundance and seen, you know, hadn't done the drive from Rifle up through Rangeley to Dinosaur Vernal on over on Route 40 in 15 years, 20 years. That area, you know, Keith Lambert, the mayor of Rifle, says, well, there's 14,000 natural drill rigs out there now. Well, he is absolutely right. I was really struck by the differences. Now, that's painful for me to see as someone who loves the natural landscape. But if we're really going to make a difference, we need to be able to reach out broadly to everybody and get everybody enthusiastic about making a change. So these characters all live along the river. They have a stake. They have a personal stake. They're making their living. They're living their lives. They're personally connected. And it's everything from, you know, the more, I would say, conservative voices of the fly fishing guide in Granby to the mayor of Ripple, on down to Jimmy Lozama, who is a bike repairman in East L.A., who's trying to, you know, use as little water as possible in the middle of Los Angeles.
Yeah.
We cover a broad spectrum of stakeholders that are deeply connected to the river. And I think by showing that broad spectrum and telling the story through people, we're going to have a chance to get people to watch and pay attention rather than to think, oh, another environmental depressing thing.
Jamie Redford is with us, a filmmaker. He produced the film Watershed. Tomorrow night, the Utah Film Center is showing Watershed at the main library in downtown Salt Lake City. The film begins at 7 o'clock. It's going to be followed by a panel discussion featuring the filmmaker, director Mark Decina, who's going to join us a little bit later here in the program. For more details on that, visit our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We need to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the Colorado River. There's a new documentary that explores the history of the river and its relationship with the arid but always growing West. There have always been disputes and demands on that water, but with climate change and a population that's expected to add 20 million in the next 40 years or so, Some are talking about a crisis which is coming unless something changes. We're profiling the film, which talks about people who are embracing a new water ethic for the West. The film is called Watershed. It's being screened tomorrow night in at the main library in downtown Salt Lake City, and we'll give you the details about that as we go along. Let me introduce, we have Jamie Redford with us, filmmaker. He produced the film Watershed. Mark Decina is joining us now. He's a filmmaker fellow at the Sundance Institute. He's joining us today from the studios of member station KQED in San Francisco. And Mark Decina, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
I wanted to start with, so we were talking with Jamie about sort of the broader ideas of the film. I wanted to start getting into some of the characters of the film. Where did you figure you would start? Not with just the characters, but in terms of how you wanted to tell the story.
Well, in working with Jamie and the producers at the Redford Center, we definitely wanted to cover a geographic diversity in the region from headwaters down to the Delta, and then also water use diversity. So that was sort of our outline for finding the characters, and then it was a matter of just starting to reach out and doing a casting, if you will. And we got lucky with all seven stories.
Well, let's start with, is it Glojean? Help me with her last name.
Todicini. Yeah, she always joked it was, people asked her if she was Italian. Todicini.
Well, she happens to be Navajo. She's the San Juan County Commissioner in Shiprock, New Mexico. And she's a really important part of the film. And in some ways, Mark Decina, she talks about how water is kind of... it's more than just a resource. It's almost a character. It plays a role, such a critical role in people's lives. Talk about that, if you would.
Sure. And Glojean, you know, we definitely look at her as sort of the spiritual center of the film.
Yeah.
I mean, water to the Navajo is something that is central to life, as it is to all of us. And I think we forget that, just being able to turn on the tap. But Glojean grew up, you know, hauling water. And, you know, more than half of the Navajo population still hauls water. And we have some footage of the film where people come in their trucks and they fill up their 50-gallon containers, and that's how they live. And I think when you live with that scarcity, you know, you're not only reminded it every day, but just reminded how essential it is to just your entire well-being, spiritually and physically.
Let me play a moment from the film. This is Glojean talking about, you know, she talks about how looking back at the, you know, at the old days where water seemed to come out of the ground and frogs used to sing. And she's talking about something that I wanted Mark Decina, you to talk about after we hear this, that something's changing and she's sensing it. Here's Glojean Todicini from the film Watershed.
If you look back in the old days when it rained a lot, there were a lot of springs. And water just came out of the ground. My mom used to say, Mother Earth has aged. The frogs used to sing for rain, and you don't hear that. It was so moist in the ground, and especially when you were planting your corn and your squash and your melons. Water, which is so precious, doesn't come like it used to.
Mark Decina, what's she talking about? That she's sensing there's a change. I mean, is she talking about climate change? She's talking about what is she getting at there?
You can call it climate change, but she is reflecting her own personal experience of water getting more and more scarce, temperatures rising. You know, many of the characters in the film talked about that without talking about climate change.
Right.
You know, even Keith Lambert in Rifle, Colorado talks about. He used to live in Phoenix and would hear the morning doves. And when he moved to higher up in Colorado, they weren't there. And then in the last few years, the morning doves are starting to migrate north. So the temperature are changing. It's getting warmer. Precipitation's getting less. You know, even in the headwater, the glacial ranges are starting to melt. And that's going to cause even more effects on the river basin.
One thing that the film profiles is the way we think about water. You know, Glojean says water is love. But then you get the sense how the average person in the Uinta Basin, in the Colorado River Basin, uses 200 gallons of water. And it points out that the average Navajo uses just 60 gallons, and half the Navajo Nation uses only 12 gallons of water a day.
Mm-hmm.
And you get back to that idea that you were talking about, Mark Dissine, about Glogene and others who have to – it has to – you know, it matters because they had to haul it, and every drop is precious. But then it's this idea that there was this ethic imposed upon them about the water. And I want to play another moment from the film, Glogene talking about – she says that her kids just think it comes from a tap. But she says she doesn't think about it that way because she learned a different idea from her elders. Here's another moment from the film Watershed.
You learn it from your elders. I could remember my grandmother, you know, the little water she had left over, and she would go and water the trees with it. Or she'd just sprinkle it and ask the holy people for that she's thankful for the having the water. The older Navajos really have a strong belief of why we're here and why we're created. To live a good, long life, you have to take care of things and so that you can continue on. And you continue on through your children.
Mark Dissine, do you think that's that? Is that the ethic you're getting at in the film?
Very, very much so. I think, you know, her comparison to her kids in this newer generation, and all of us, really. I mean, we get our water by turning on the tap, and there's no connection to source. Source of water and, you know, source of many things in our lives are just, they're so convenient. And I think Jamie talks about this as well, is that the policies that are set forth on water and pricing is that it's not valuable. It's not valuable enough that we can turn on the tap, brush our teeth, let it run. You know, we wash our cars, we you know, water our lawns, and we're basically watering the sidewalks as we do because there's no value put on it as much as it should be.
I wanted to ask you about this idea of the ethic. I mean, the Outward Bound program you profile in the film, young people getting a different sense of it. Is that getting at this idea of imposing a new kind of sensibility on younger people, getting them thinking about it at an earlier age?
Sure, sure. And, you know, I had the really good fortune of going on a river trip with my kids on that same stretch of the river in the Gates of Lodore. And I personally saw it in their eyes that, you know, most of the kids growing up these days, their connection to the world is through a smartphone or through the internet. And the Outward Bound program, you know, and many programs like this throughout the basin that try to get kids out on the river is just getting them again to that source, to that, you know, native connection to water. And, you know, I saw the transformation in these kids in a matter of 3 days where, you know, they're first jittery that they can't, you know, tap into their music or they can't get on their smartphone. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, I think there's a moment in the film where they've forced them to be silent at the confluence of the Yampa, the last free-flowing river in the basin, with the green. And you could just see them awaken in this magical rock formation and two rivers flowing together. And, you know, I think there is an appreciation. And then you tell them, you know, as we were questioning some of the kids, that there was this river does not reach its source anymore. It dries up before it reaches, you know, the Gulf of California. And I think they are genuinely shocked, as many people are when they see the film, that, you know, the visceral reaction of seeing a former 2-million-acre wetland now a part of the Sonoran Desert. It's awakening.
Let's talk about another character in the film, Jimmy Lissama. Jamie Redford mentioned him. He's founder of this bicycle kitchen. He's in East L.A. How did you strike upon him as a character to talk about the Colorado River?
Right. Yeah, that was a stroke of luck, as of many of these. I mean, we were down to our last character. We were searching for a strong urban character. And through the Graywater Gorillas, they're a group based out of the Bay Area, they mentioned Jimmy, who lives in East L.A., a native, you know, an urbanist. He loves living in the urban environment and loves L.A., but he doesn't have a bike. He's just very aware of many of the issues that have to do with water, and that the L.A. River just is allowed to flow right into the sea, where it could be supporting these, you know, it's in its LA's own natural watershed could support millions of people if they were to tap into it. So it was, you know, again, a stroke of luck, but, you know, he's one of my favorite characters. I ride my bike as well, and I just connected with him on many, many levels.
Folks are so out to take care of their own that they forget that this is a whole living city, and together we can make it an awesome place. Alone, you just create a lot of strife between all the aloneness between people. I was born here. I grew up here. I know it. Then as I grew up a little more, it became even more poetic how much I love the city. And then I started to see what was wrong with my city. And then it became this louder cry for, okay, how can I improve this wonderful place that I'm in? And how can I play a role in that, you know? So.
Mark Ticino, the thing that I kept thinking about in that section was he talks about how, you know, doesn't want to do it alone. And, you know, there's that myth of the West that it's just about the individual. But it seems like the message of the West is that the reason people have survived here is that they did get together. And I was thinking about that when Jimmy talked about the fact that, you know, he wants to improve this place, but he doesn't want to just do it alone, I guess.
Right. And it's especially surprising, you know, in a city where you think people are isolated. But he embraces a thing called permaculture, which I found fascinating as a concept where, you know, you use all the resources, including earth. I mean, there's so much in the cities that are, you know, we cement over and we forget that, you know, the dirt and earth is what allows us to grow food. And so he uses, you know, the gray water from his bath and to water his garden. He's got, you know, a banana tree in the backyard, and it's really a magical place. I never would have thought L.A., you know, would be that way. And I, you know, like a San Franciscan, I'm supposed to not like L.A., but I really love L.A., and that was an eye-opener, too, just to see someone living a life there that's embracing different things, you know.
Mark Ticino is with us. He's a filmmaker, director of the documentary film Watershed, Finding a New Water Ethic for the New West. Tomorrow night, the Utah Film Center is showing the film at the Main Library in downtown Salt Lake City. The film begins at 7. It's going to be followed by a panel discussion featuring Mark Ticino. For details about that, visit our website, radiowest.kuer.org. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the Colorado River, a new documentary, in fact, that explores the history of the river and its relationship with the growing West. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. The film is called Watershed, Finding a New Water Ethic for the New West. It's being screened tomorrow night in downtown Salt Lake City at the library there. We'll give you details about that as we go. Let's take a call. Daniel is joining us in Provo. Daniel, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to say first, I appreciate what one of the filmmakers said about how we value water, I guess, don't value water. I think that's a part of this that needs to be talked about more. And I certainly talk about myself in that regard as well. But the question that I had is something more along the lines of like this idea of having a stake or an ownership claim or an entitlement to the water. And I guess I'd appreciate if the guests can kind of talk about that generally, but also in relationship to the way that maybe the states and the compact that was forged among the states who rely on the Colorado divvied it up and how it stands today. And my understanding is also that Mexico was part of that, and they're kind of getting shafted at the very end there, no pun intended.
Well, Mark, you seem to talk about that because the film does take on the Colorado River Compact, which was drafted in 1922. It talks about the fact that the allocations were based on an unusually wet period of time, promised more water than it could deliver. And you sort of pose the question of maybe these ideas should be, you know, rethought or reworked in some ways. Talk about that.
Sure. And that is like the third rail to talk about the River Compact. Yeah. and water rights. But You know, in the initial agreement, Mexico wasn't even considered. It was just divvied up between the seven states. And, you know, through later negotiations, it was added on. But they only receive 1.5 million acre feet of the 13.5 to 14 million acre feet. You know, and as you mentioned, the Colorado River Compact was done when the river flow was at 17. So it was this abnormally wet year. So already we're in trouble with the amount of water that's actually divvied up, and then with adding populations and, you know, increasing climate temperatures. But it's the law of the river. You know, it goes back to, and I'm not a water expert, but as I understand it, the water rights, you know, senior water rights, it's one of the aberrations of the West. Jeff Ellert likes to say, or his, my favorite quote is from him, is, "Whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting," and you know that's sort of the stage that's set. You know, if you first come to the land and you have water rights, you have senior water rights. You can call those rights in whenever you want them. You know, and you know it's a hard thing to give up. And there's also a use it or lose it clause that if you don't use your allocation, then you're in danger of losing your water rights. So, you know, the incentives and the policies that are set in place need to be looked at. You know, this film is not proposing any answers, but it's, again, starting the dialogue and you know, trying to call some attention to, we need to think about this differently.
And Jamie Redford, I just wanted to give you the opportunity to respond if you wanted.
Well, yes. I think, you know, I do think that there are some significant, I don't think we're paying for water the way we should. I think, you know, we live in a different world than we did when these rights were divvied up. It's time to check in and revise. And I think that goes for water rights as well. I mean, historically, water was seen as a way to encourage economic growth. And as you could see from what Peter McBride said, you know, there is a $26 billion industry on the river that is really a new economy. You know, as our world in the West has gotten more crowded and people have become to, you know, appreciate what they actually have with nature, I think that economy is going to become increasingly important and a real opportunity for Westerners. But the old model really encouraged, you know, using water to create opportunities and jobs. And currently, you know, the use it or lose it policy, you know, my feeling, being familiar with it from being a part-time resident in Utah, is that that's another thing that would be nice to look at again.
Peter McBride, what do you think about all of that? These are ideas you've been thinking a lot about in the past couple of years.
Sure. Well, just to get back to the caller's question, will they revisit the compact? I think everyone's talking about that, and the compact basically believed that there was a river that flowed at X, and we now realize it flows at 3/4 X, but everybody wants their straw in the cup for X. And so there's a lot of people, particularly the state of Colorado, are afraid that if we revisit it and redo it and make the law fit to the actual numbers of the river flow, that they're going to lose water in the deal, and it's going to go to a larger populous state like California. So I don't think that there's going to be any complete rewriting of the compact, but I do think there'll be some bending of it, and I think we probably are going to be forced to moving towards a direction of a percentage base out of the river. The river is divided into two basins, upper and lower. In the upper basin, we do a percentage base calculations on how much water we pull more than the lower basin. So I think that may be one solution. And then as a whole, I think rules like use it and lose it are critical, and we need to bend those and twist them too. So the law really says use it or for its best benefit, and so we need to clarify what is the best use of that water. And there are rules in place now that they were using in the state, up here in the state of Colorado, where you could actually donate your water back to the river for a 3-year period if you're in agriculture. But I think there's some bright water lawyers out there and nonprofits working around these models to try to tweak these rules to make them beneficial for all of us. And it makes me hopeful. But this one point on the film Watershed, where I think it's great with all the use of all the individuals in it, is that I think we all need to realize that we're all users of this river. It's not just the guy downstream or the woman, you know, downstate or whatever, or the industry. It's all of us. And we all need to be more aware of it, from what we put on our lawns. What is our lawn? Should it be Kentucky bluegrass, or should it be something more native to a more arid landscape?
Mm-hmm. Mark Ticino, I wanted to talk about another one of the characters in the film, Dave James. He's this artisan cheesemaker in Durango. I guess he's a
Dan
rancher.
James.
Say that again.
Dan James. Dave is his dad.
Dan James. Talk about him as a character, because he has such a farmer in Virginia, Joel Salatin, who has a similar kind of idea. We've talked to him before in this program, talking about how you let animals be animals. That is, you use the natural process. And it seems like this is something that's really important for him. Talk about Dan James.
Sure. Yeah. And choosing him, you know, with agriculture using 70% of the water, it was a very difficult, choice for a character, because there's, you could consider 70% of the film should be about agriculture.
Yeah.
But, he represented a use of the water that, they use water, definitely. They're blessed with water, as he says, but they return the water in even better condition. They're on the Animas River, and there's a lot of mining upstream. And as it flows through their land for their irrigation, it comes back out enriched with life. So that was a very important thing, that they don't use petrochemical fertilizers or pesticides. They're embracing, a way of life that is on the path to sustainability, as opposed to, the current path we're on. We keep going with a lot of the industrial agriculture it's a lot of industry in general. Mm-hmm. We're running up against it quickly. And water is just the canary in the coal mine. It's just one of the acute things that we're going to feel right away.
Here's Dan James from the film Watershed.
So somebody, and I'd like to know who it was, got the great idea, well, let's take the animals off the land. Let's confine them in small spaces and feed them these surpluses of grain. Well, cows were never meant to eat grain. Their systems are designed to eat grass. So when Becca, my wife, and I started to consider dairying, we visited all these dairies, and inevitably it's some 70-plus-year-old gentleman, spraying chemicals on pastures and crops and mass quantities of petrochemical fertilizers. Those old guys had like 10 kids, and they're scattered to all ends of the earth because they worked 365, milking cows twice a day, 5 a.m., 5 p.m., and as soon as they turned like 18 years old in a day, they were out of there, never to return. That was one of the conditions, is that we were going to do it differently, or we weren't going to do it at all.
It's Dan James from the film Watershed. We're running out of time, and I want to get to the story of Rifle, Colorado. Mark Ticino, talk about, this is the mayor that you profile, Keith Lambert. We see him. And I think what's so extraordinary about Keith Lambert is he talks about how, and we have a moment from this film, but with the mayor, but he talks about how they were able to accomplish a kind of a new sensibility about energy, renewable energy, in a pretty conservative place. Talk about the mayor of Rifle, Colorado, if you would, Keith Lambert.
Sure. And it's, very conservative. They're surrounded by 14,000 gas wells. It's the big extraction industry. They're looking at oil shale development. And, we didn't use the quote in the film, but he says, he's always asked or told, we have 100 years of gas left, and, we can, the country can live off that. But his question is always, well, what about after the 100 years? What then? So, his, charge as mayor was to get people to think about renewable energy, and they are working with many NGOs in the area, but they have one of the largest community solar arrays in the country. A lot of the businesses have taken it on, and they consider themselves an energy village in the middle of one of the heaviest oil and gas extraction, you know, parts of the country. So he's really leading the charge, and I think he's retired as a mayor since the film has come out. But you know, it was not an easy thing for him to talk about. It was in that community, but you know, I think we don't realize that, you know, we think of conservative people, quote unquote, in this community, that they're actually, you know, conservative in the sense that they are the original recyclers. They are very conservative about, you know, energy use and, you know, the resource use. And, you know, it's a matter of just changing their perspective a little bit. And he said that it's taken off like wildfire in that country, in the city.
Well, I guess the question is, and Jamie Redford and Peter McBride, I wanted to get you on this question too, because the idea of whether there's the political will to make these kinds of changes, I guess the story of Rifle Colorado has got to give you some sense of hope. I mean, especially in a narrow political climate, you know, where there's skepticism about climate change, you know, there's a lot of questions about, you know, removing regulations to energy production. I mean, Rifle Colorado has got to give you some sense that there is some political will out there to do this.
Well, I would say yes, and I think you know that it's going to take a shift in policy to make real, lasting, substantial changes. But I do think awareness and visceral awareness and an emotional connection to this issue is going to have to come first. I mean, if you live in Ripple, you know, it's pretty clear if you live there. What we're giving up in order to create more energy resources there. So it's not, it's inspiring, but it's not entirely surprising that they happen to be motivated to look for more sustainable solutions, because it does feel when you go through there that it's not sustainable in the long term. And when I say long term, let's look to the Navajos, you know, a lot of other nations and tribes who ascribe by the seven generation, you know, philosophy of how to take care of our sustainability. That you know, they are getting a direct signal as to what's at stake living in Ripple. And I think I want the film to bring that these issues into everybody's living rooms and in screening rooms throughout the West, because I think you really have to feel it, experience it emotionally. And that's the brilliance about Marcus and his work. I mean, prior to our project, you know, we'd done a number of short films together for the Redford Center, and he really understands people, and he knows how to bring them alive in a way that is accessible and meaningful. And I think before we get policy change, you know, the 30 million and growing people in the West are just going to have a better connection to the source of water.
Peter McBride, I wanted to get you on that point as well.
Yeah, I'll jump in. Our family used to actually run cattle in Ripple, so I spent a lot of my summers there, and I think it's great. It's highlighted in the film, and I think their mayor's done a great job. But I would say beyond the next to the Delta, Ripple could be, like, in my opinion, DEFCON 3 on the river. They've the farm we used to run our cattle on, and every neighboring farm has been turned into a gravel pit, and there's been no wetlands restoration whatsoever. So I think it's somewhat symbolic of some of the attitudes of how we treat this river, again, back to it being like a plumbing system. But I do think there's hope out there, and I think, like Jamie points out, awareness is key. I think this drought we've had should really be instrumental in making us aware this drought may be more closer to actual long-term projections of the river than what we think. And I think hopefully that'll kick us into gear to be better stewards of this remarkable river.
Mark DeSena, let me ask you this finally, less than a minute left. I mean, Dan James talks about, Peter McBride just talked about it, this idea that they're sensing, beginning to be some sense of hope. Are you seeing the landscape shifting at all?
I think it is. I mean, you know, the experience that we've had screening the film, people are responding to it. I mean, we're growing numbers, you know, are joining up the cause. And, you know, the action campaign is to try to reconnect the river to the sea, to the Gulf of California, and only 2% more flow is needed. And I think that can be achieved. And Dan James even says it, you know, he's a plenitude of water, and he says, yeah, I could do that. We all could do it. We can all conserve water, make a pledge, you know, go to watershedmovie.com and, you know, pledge to the Delta Water Trust. And they are, securing water rights to not restore 2 million-acre wetlands, but to connect the river to the sea. The American Nile should be connected to the sea.
It's Mark DeSena. He joined us from KQED in San Francisco. Thanks very much for the time.
Thank you.
Jamie Redford, thanks very much to you. And Peter McBride, thank you as well. Tomorrow night, the Utah Film Center showing Watershed at the main library in downtown Salt Lake City. Go to our website for the details. Radio West, a production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.